Hello, everybody. I'm Kevin Witham. Welcome to Season 4 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus prayed for unity so that the world may believe. Our mission is to connect and gather with Christians outside one's family of churches because we believe unity starts by building relationships. We say unity starts with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another conversation.
Hello and welcome to episode 147 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Before we get started, I'd like to start with some words of encouragement. We are recording this episode on October 31st, but it will be airing on November 8th, which means that between recording time and air date, the U.S. election polls will have closed, and it's possible that you, our listeners, may know who the next president of the United States will be, even if I currently don't. So it's my prayer that regardless of who wins the presidential election, along with all the other levels of government, all of us who will follow Christ will commit ourselves to embodying the fruits of the Spirit in all our interactions. I pray that our words and actions will be characterized by love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Our hope does not depend on who is in office, but on the one who is enthroned above all. Okay, with that said, let's get on to introduce our guest for today, Tiffany Dahlman. Tiffany Dahlman is the lead minister at Courtyard Church of Christ in North Carolina. She is also the Associate Dean for Vocational Formation at ACU Dallas and Program Director for their online Bible and ministry coursework and church leadership certificates. She holds an MDiv with concentrations in Old Testament and spiritual formation from Asbury Theological Seminary and a doctorate in preaching for community transformation from ACU. She lives with her family, perfectly situated between the mountains and the sea in North Carolina. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thanks, Drew. I've got my Common Grounds coffee cup here. Excellent. So I am fully prepared for this interview.
Way to rep. We appreciate that. As we get started, in your work with ACU, you get to engage students with a wide variety of ages, ethnicities, beliefs, and vocational goals. So how would you describe in broad strokes the current state of Christianity in the United States?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and I'm not an expert on the state of Christianity in the United States by any means, like our friends Gallup and the Pew Research Center right. And such. But we can read the data, and we do have quite a bit of quantitative data coming out about this decline that's happening. I think that's a true statement. We see a big decline. Back when you and I were coming onto planet Earth in the 70s, only 5% or so of people in the United States said that they were of no religious affiliation, whereas now we're up to a quarter of the country saying they don't have any religious affiliation. And church attendance, of course, is down at least 10% every 10 years. We're seeing this phenomenon as well. So definitely a decline. But I think that great fear, or maybe early assumption, that atheism was skyrocketing isn't what we're seeing. It's just a move from organized Christianity, but there's still a lot of spirituality different manifestations that's certainly there. So if I had to put it in a sentence, maybe I would say that Christianity in the United States is without a common narrative and responding to the effects of metamodernism, which might be a new phrase, and we can unpack that if you want, but I think that's what we're looking at now.
Yeah, that's an interesting phrase. I like thinking about the status of being without a narrative, because, you know, for most of Christianity, it's deeply embedded in story. You know, all throughout the Old Testament, you see this reciting of stories of what God has done in the past and where we come from and where we're headed, and same thing in the New Testament, and then throughout historical Christianity, there's this tradition. You know, you're looking back at the church, the fathers, and where we've come from, and you're embedded in this story. And even in the Protestant Reformation, there's still these stories that shape who you are as a Christian. But now you're saying, you know, a lot of people who would maybe say they believe in God or in Jesus are disconnected from any kind of narrative belonging? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think we're seeing second and even third generations of people who've never been to church, never read the Bible, never heard the story at all. So there's that. And though in the past we would have different demographics of Christians or different denominations telling different versions of the good news, like the Black church might be telling the good news of the liberation story, or Reformers might be telling the good news of the salvation story, you know, but they're all from the scripture, but it's all good news. But now there's strains of the story that aren't even good news to people. We're not even sure what the news is, if it's good news, what's the good news. So there's kind of this chaos around what the story is we're even telling. And that tracks when we look at the move from modernism, postmodernism, and now metamodernism. I think this tracks, and churches are just struggling to find their way in that.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that meta-modernism.
Yeah. I mean, if people really want to dig into it, I published a paper on it in the Religions magazine recently, earlier this year, so I won't get into all of it. But we're in a new sociological phenomenon in the United States. And when you're in the midst of something, it's hard to get really great data to discern it very clearly. Hindsight is always 20/20. However, meta, being with or beyond, is not necessarily a total shift from postmodernism where we were before, but it's picking up some of postmodernism. It's picking up some of modernism, but it is a response to that. If we think back in the 50s, our grandparents' church, you know, there was a truth. The Bible is the absolute truth. This is the truth. And those telling the story were of a common demographic. Those interpreting the scripture were mostly older white men, and that was the truth of the story. And then postmodernism came along, of course, in the 70s, rise of the civil rights movement, feminism, and we start hearing more stories. And it was a needed, necessary, good correction. I know some people think postmodernism is a dirty word, but I mean necessary. This is how we started to hear the voices from the global South and feminist theology, and it really flushed out and added to this breadth and depth of God in the story that was so, so great. But when you apply that to the greater culture of the United States, social media rising up in there too, you know, is another a factor. We ended up with so many versions of the truth, with politics, with culture, with music, with education, and the church, and so many versions of the truth, it kind of led to this place of chaos. And that postmodernism bubble kind of burst. Nothing is true. We have this despair. There's no truth. Nothing is true. We can't stand on anything. We don't know. And nobody likes to be in chaos. And so when I see the church in the United States right now responding to metamodernism, or responding to this bubble burst of postmodernism, I think some churches are reacting with kind of a neo-modernism, going back hardcore. Nope, there's one truth. It is absolute truth. And this is it, you know, just really digging in their heels. But other churches are saying, hey, is there another way? Well, I guess there's those churches responding to postmodernism and just kind of throwing up their hands. Like, you're right, there's no truth. Forget this whole thing. And we have ministers losing their faith and Christians losing their faith. But to respond in a metamodern way would be to say there is a truth, but it's going to be a whole lot more complex than the truth we knew before. And some philosophers like Ibram Hassan would say, in a metamodern age, truth and trust go together. We're going to discern truth in communities of trust. And I think that's a space where the church can really restore that good news narrative again. How can we tell something that's true, not so black and white, something very complex, but beautiful? Might take a long time, but through the many voices, a varied community of people we trust. I think that's a great hope for the church.
Yeah. That goes to something I have been focusing on a lot, is just listening well, listening in community, you know, being able to set your own perspective alongside, not dismissing it, not, you know, or not saying what I believe is the absolute truth, but, you know, being able to sit at the same table with other people and listening well to other people's perspectives, you know, that like critical realism, the way of reading scripture that incorporates lots of different kinds of voices. And There's a book that I'm sure you're probably familiar with, Communities of Informed Judgment. It's by Fred Aquino. And it kind of talks about how we can listen to, or we do listen to all these different communities, the medical community. We can trust them because there are these multiplicity of voices that discern what is best. And anyway, sorry, I'm kind of rambling off there, but
Go ahead. Yeah, that takes spiritual discipline, I think, doesn't it? Because when we're feeling unsettled and we want to know the answer to something, it's easier to just react in some sort of absolute truth. It takes some spiritual discipline and maybe spiritual maturity that churches could nurture to say, hey, maybe you're not going to get an answer today, right now. We might have to listen and gather information and hear a lot more voices. It might take years before we get to some common ground on what we believe, something to stand on. But that's the better way, I think, the healthier way.
Yeah. So, you know, in your engagement with different students, how do you see this affecting them? What concerns do they have? Do you see a lot of this disorientation, this chaotic, I don't know what to believe, or is there more hope? Or, you know, what are you sensing in the pulse of the people you come across?
Yeah, it's all of it. I think it's all of it. There's those who have just become quite dogmatic in this age, and then there's those who have given up on all of it. It just makes no sense. They can't get their head above the water, or they've been harmed by church, or just so disillusioned. Yeah. And then there's those seeking a third way who are very curious and listening. Some of them have a desperation. Like, I don't want to give this up. I really want to believe, but I just need it to be good news again. So there's all of it. But our churches, as you know, or our students are nearly all from Texas, which this shift that we have in Christianity in the United States is, it varies by geographical region. So the state of the church in Texas is not the same as here in North Carolina or in Montana.
Mm-hmm. Or in the global South or China.
For sure.
We tend to think Christianity in our little tiny circles, but there's so much more to what God's doing in the world. So what have you observed that excites you or gives you hope in, say, younger generations or just emerging ways of conceiving Christianity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, certainly people who are responding in a metamodern way rather than pendulum swinging from one to the other, I would say that. But I've been reading a lot of Andrew Root lately. For whatever reason, I was invited into different panels and discussions to discuss Root stuff. So just looking at his corpus on the secular age, and he's, of course, pulling from Charles Taylor and Carmen Rosa and others, but you know, Root would say that he would issue a warning against churches responding to phase two of secularization, which Charles Taylor would say, hey, first, if you're entering a secular age, your society becomes disenchanted. That would be phase one. Phase two, people quit going to religious services. And we're seeing that, right? Less and less people going to church. So the go to church problem, that would be phase two of secularization. And Root is saying, you know, hey, we see a lot of churches trying to address that problem, the get people back into church problem. Mm-hmm. And they're doing that with innovation, branding, marketing programs, you know, this kind of mega model, seeker friendly model that we see. That I don't want to totally knock that style. People meet Jesus there. I acknowledge that. But if you're asking where I really see hope, it's in those churches or those Christians who are seeking to address phase three. And Charles Taylor would say phase three of secularization is when the society enters a place where belief itself is a bit ridiculous or elusive to even go out and say, I don't believe in Jesus. It's pretty common. And to say, hey, I'm a Christian, people are going to start to look at you funny. When you get to that point, you've entered phase three. Yeah. And so Root saying, can we address phase three? What does that look like for a church? And that looks very different, right? That's where you get smaller community. You get people, instead of innovating, they're pointing out resonance, to use Rosa's language. Where's the new creation in breaking among us? Where do we see resurrection? Where do we experience God? In trusting, diverse, small community. That's very exciting to me.
That's good. That affirms something I'm wanting to, I'm laying the groundwork for what I hope will be a pretty broad study next year in doing an appreciative inquiry of what has God been doing in our midst in the restoration movement across the board, and paying attention to God is present. God is active. God is doing something. He hasn't left us abandoned. And then, you know, leaning into that, and how do we participate with what God is doing? And I think there's a lot of overlap there in that phase three of, you know, let's notice what is there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so much that you're pulling from of what the Spirit has been doing, even in this geographic location we call the United States, in this time of saying, hey, there is a truth to be found. There is a story, a common narrative here. But how can we hear it by slowing down? How can we hear it with diverse voices? How can we hear it among people we trust? And then just tell that story, because that fosters faith and that stokes belief, rather than saying, oh, the problem is get people back into a building. Because that gets real gimmicky really quick.
I haven't read the stuff you referenced. I know of Charles Taylor, and I know I need to read him. I know of Andrew Root, and I have read some of his stuff, but I don't think this specific content. But I would suspect that focusing on phase three might lead back into a re-enchantment that by paying attention to what God's doing in community, you might be able to, that would carry over into the broader world of seeing everything through an enchanted lens. Does that track?
Absolutely. Because that is very much alive in the United States. I mean, that Harry Potter generation grew up, right? We've got, we have three Wiccan stores in our little town, you know, I mean, like there's enchantment all over. So to say that we're not enchanted or that people aren't spiritual anymore, I think is a myth. It just looks very different. But yeah, if we can point it out, that resonance, and call it Jesus, right? And say, hey, this is the inbreaking of the new creation, because I see the characteristics of God in it as God defines God's self in the scriptures. That's just very redeeming.
Yeah, letting the narrative of scripture be normative for what you observe in nature, not just being, you know, oh, that's a tree, it must be God, you know, that doesn't track.
Yeah.
So, in addition to your ministry at a church, you're also the Associate Dean of Vocational Formation, and you're involved in all these different programs that I'll ask you about in a minute. But I mention this now because it's clear to me you do have your finger on the pulse. Granted, you're not, you know, a primary researcher like Barna or Pew or any of that stuff, but you are in these panels. You're in several different settings where you're able to hear from voices within churches and leadership. So anyway, before the pandemic, we were already facing an unprecedented wave of ministers who are leaving or seriously considering leaving full-time ministry. But that's been, you know, 4 or 5 years now since that research was done. What trends have you seen among ministers and other church leaders since that time? What are you seeing in them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, even though I'm in North Carolina, I have a really big megaphone of Texas in my ear, because so much of it is Texas. And what's going on in Texas is not indicative of the rest of the country. Mm. But even there, we're seeing these same trends, I think, of ministers leaving, but for so many different reasons. Sometimes it is that disillusionment of faith. This deconstruction affects ministers too. Sometimes they're leaving churches by choice. They're burnt out, used up, washed out, exhausted, and sometimes it's not by choice. They chose to use their God-given prophetic voice, and it backfired, and they're out of what's going on in the world. You know, this happens. And as churches close, positions close. And that is certainly a pattern I'm seeing. It's kind of that second string of ministry. Those positions are being eliminated just because churches can't financially support them anymore. Your associate ministers, executive ministers, children's ministers, that world.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of what you do is helping to equip church leaders that are maybe not full-time, maybe they're part-time, maybe they're vocational, like they have other jobs and they're serving in ministry, or they're elders and other church leaders. ACU is offering several opportunities that I'm really excited about, and that's one of the primary reasons I wanted to have you on is a lot of our listeners are involved in ministry of some form or fashion, and these opportunities for being equipped and growing and learning, I think are just so important and so valuable. So I want to just offer you the opportunity to talk a little bit about these different offerings and talk about maybe who they would benefit and how. So first, you know, the bachelor's degrees, everybody who goes through the ACU online has to take some Bible courses. And then there are others who specialize in ministry type kind of things. So how does ACU, or what is ACU offering to people who are looking for a bachelor's experience?
Yeah. And this is ACU Online or ACU Dallas. And even though we've been around 7-8 years, some people aren't aware that we exist or what we do. So the Dallas world is 100% online. It doesn't require a move. It doesn't require, you know, going to class with a bunch of 19-year-olds. That's not what's happening. It's asynchronous, which means it's in your own time for the most part. So it's very accessible for people to do what ACU, but you still have the ACU name, you have the ACU accreditation, you have the best of ACU, but it's all online. And in that, I'm going to say ACU Dallas from now on, because that's how we usually talk about it. But ACU Dallas, we have a bachelor's degree. It's called Christian Ministry and Spiritual Formation for those who need a bachelor's degree. And it still surprises me, but we have church leaders, even in the pulpit ministry role, who their education of that might've been a mentor, who kind of mentored them into that role, but they never had any theological, formal theological education, or maybe they went to a preaching school, one of our many preaching schools, but didn't get that formal theological education. So that bachelor's degree is there. And I love it because it's unique in that it has all three pillars. You can go get a degree, like a bachelor's degree in biblical studies or even in spiritual formation, but ours has all three. It's got biblical studies, spiritual formation, and ministry in a contemporary age. So all three of those pillars are fully explored, which I think offers a much more holistic equipping for ministry rather than just focusing on one or the other.
Right. Yeah. So like you mentioned, there's a lot of churches, especially rural congregations, that, you know, it's hard to get people pulled in to minister in the middle of nowhere, with high credentials or anything. So a lot of churches do just rely on, volunteers and people who are called but not necessarily trained. That's one way to, you know, the bachelor's programs, but talk about these certificates in church leadership, because I think that's something that would be such a gift to ministers and church leaders in rural settings or in urban settings as well. But what are those, the certificate in church leadership, foundations, and then also practice?
Yeah. And I, maybe before getting into that, Drew, it's helpful to explore that other phenomenon you're talking about of bivocational ministry or solving the preacher shortage problem, that we don't have enough people applying for these jobs or who are wanting these jobs, especially in rural areas. And that leads to bivocational ministry. But I don't know that that's bad news. I think that's part of the solution. We're talking about hope and why we have church leadership certificates, because this can be good news. This isn't a new thing. This is tent making. This is Paul. This is, you know, bivocational ministry. It's not bad to untangle mortgages and health insurance from the whims of the congregation. That can be very freeing for a pulpit minister. And it's very freeing for the spirit. The truth can flow a lot freer when all your eggs aren't in one basket.
Yeah.
Is, you know, something women in ministry have been doing for a long time. We've always kind of quilted together a living wage, and now we're seeing it men too. And you're like, oh no, what is this? And like, well, let me explain it. This is how this can work. I think you and I both are kind of bivocational in these ways, but it can be a really beautiful way to make a living wage because it's not boring. You're doing something different days of the week and all that. But yeah, with that factor, I think the church leadership certificates are really useful and meaningful and helpful, not just for those pulpit ministers or second level ministers who never had that formal theological education, but say your elders or your leadership board, or if you don't have a pulpit minister now in your church, you're volunteering, you have a preaching rotation or something like that. There's no education there. If there is, it's training. Do you know what I mean by that? Like they're reiterating what they have been trained and what they've been taught. It's an echo chamber of information.
Yeah.
And maybe you've had that experience where the elders, I think that's what we call them all across the restoration movement, is elders or elder board, your leadership team. They're adopting into the church the same strategies from the corporate world. So you have corporate leadership strategies instead of family systems theory strategies, which can harm a church really quickly. And they just don't know. Like nobody told them, hey, this is a different organism. This is a different thing. Yeah. So those certificates, especially for elders, are really, really good news. Or for churches who don't have a pulpit minister anymore, maybe one who never got any formal training in that, even if they have a master's degree or they're a brain surgeon, but they never had any formal biblical education. It's a great solution.
Say an elder says, you know, I think I'd like this church leadership certificate. Is it a two-part thing? They start off with foundations and moved on to practice, or can you start with praxis and what does it look like? What does the journey look like there?
Yeah. And so people can jump on pretty much anytime because our terms are really short. They're only 7 weeks long, but foundations is first. So there's two of them that are offered. Each one is five classes with one capstone at the end. And it's kind of becoming my favorite part of my job because the students who are in there, they're just so fun. It's so fun. And the last capstone, I just taught it last term. It was a capstone for the foundation certificate. And it was one gentleman in his 60s who was the pulpit minister at a Church of God in Christ, so Black Pentecostalism. And in these capstone projects, they're taking all the content from the certificate and doing like a mini dissertation, like a mini intervention, teeny tiny intervention with what they've learned. So he's trying to address the problem of resistance to change in this small congregation, like nothing new there, right? Like they're stuck in their tradition of their heritage. And then there was this Texas gentleman in his 50s, big Texas mega church. And his problem was they were short on volunteers. So he did this project to discern how many more they needed. Drew, I kid you not, they needed 600 more volunteers to keep their ministries growing. And that was a feasible goal. I'm like, this is a town. Like, we don't have churches like that in North Carolina. They're just massive churches, but so different in conversation with this other guy who's at this small, you know, under 100 Church of God in Christ tradition. And then there was a woman in there who was Lutheran, ECLA, in a smaller church. And she was trying to reimagine their youth ministry from something that was not mere entertainment, but formative. And so they're in conversation with each other and trying to work it out. And we're looking at appreciative inquiry, like you mentioned, and all the content. But in that one, in the foundations, they're covering biblical interpretation. They take one and two. How do we read the Bible outside of patternism? You know, is there another way? The best practices of interpretation. They take an upper level Bible course to put those methods into practice. I'm teaching Wisdom Lit right now. That's one of the options, or Paul's Letters, Mark. Then they take a church leadership, a Christian leadership course, where they learn the differences between secular approaches and family systems theory, you know, how to lead churches healthily. And then they take a course, either spiritual formation or living the mission, for those internal disciplines to be able to embody a sustaining ministry and how to tell a good news story in our time. And then the capstone on top of that. That's the foundation. That's awesome.
And so when they complete that capstone, they get the foundation certificate, and then they can re-enroll to go on to the Praxis.
Yeah, they can re-enroll. And enrollment is easy. I mean, you can just reach out. If you go to the website, you're going to get the chat bot that pops up in the corner, and you can just respond to it or just reach out to the ACU Dallas registration. But so the Praxis one is where they put into Praxis those foundations. So there's a pastoral ministry course where they go over the basics of preaching, how to craft a sermon, pastoral care, how to do that in a way that does not harm people. They explore some of the sacraments, like what's happening at the communion table, what do we believe about this, begin to apply some of this biblical interpretation stuff to the life of the church. They do a course on teaching and learning for spiritual formation. I think we've all been in that class, right? Where the elder lectures at you for 45 minutes information. And can we do that differently? Can we teach for formation? They take a course. Charles Kaiser did this great course, Contemporary Ecclesiology, on maybe fresh expressions. Does church have to look the same as it always has? How can we reimagine it differently in our time? There's a course in there called Gospel in a Multicultural World. How do we hear other voices? Again, where's the good news? What's the good news story we're telling? And then they have a capstone at the top of that one as well.
Well, cool. So, and those are offered to anybody regardless of, like, there any prerequisites for that? Do you need any prior? I didn't think so.
No. I mean, we do ask that they submit these letters of recommendation. There's two letters of recommendation from their church that just vouches that the individual applying has enough voice in their congregation to be able to do those capstone projects. Either they're on leadership themselves, or they have relationships solid enough with the leadership that they can do the work, because we try to have all of our work actually embedded in the context of the student. It's not theoretical. It's very practical. And there's a short essay just explaining, why do you want to do this? What's your interest? And I guess the hidden agenda of that there is I am checking a little bit of ability, because you're going to jump right into 300 level courses. You're not going to take Bible 101 for that. And we need to know that the student can handle that, but that's never been an issue.
But that's not a formal requirement. Like, you have to have this many hours of.
No other. Yeah, you don't have to have ever had a bachelor's degree, or like I said, you could be a brain surgeon, but never had any formal theological training or training on how to do church in a way that's healthy.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So that's different from the, there's graduate certificates that are being offered. Now, I think this might not be directly under your realm, but certificate in conflict management for church leaders. Is that one that requires a bachelor's?
Yeah, they would need a bachelor's for any master's certificate. And that one has kind of been dormant for a while. But we do have master's online, master's level degrees, and they are situated in Abilene. They're hybrid programs. They're not 100% online, but Tara Harmon is the program director for those. So I encourage people to reach out to them if they're looking for a master's, like a master's in Christian ministry or an MDiv, something like that.
Yeah. So what are some things that you are hoping to see as we move forward in America? You know, as we talked about, it's been a very tumultuous time the past several years. What are some things that you're seeing that I'm trying not to restate the question I said, what gives you hope, but say in 5-10 years, what would you like to see different in American Christianity?
Trust restored, I think, among the different iterations of Christianity that we're seeing now. It reminds me of what Jesus may have been witnessing between those who are worshiping in Samaria and those who are worshiping in Jerusalem. You know, this is the same religion, but is it even recognizable? Would they even consider it the same religion? I'm seeing so many vastly different iterations of the faith right now. And so I would like to see goodness win, right? The fruit of the goodness, just be so abundantly clear that those that aren't life-giving, those that aren't fruit-producing, just kind of, you know, fade out. That crop doesn't last. Maybe that doesn't happen. That kind of goes out. But then I think trust can be restored among these different groups of Christians who might just have different worship practices, who kind of caught up in a narrative, but they're not propagating it themselves. But we're so polarized. It's more than just polarization. I'm trying not to use that word because there's three or four different directions things are going right now. But man, that was Jesus's dying wish prayer, wasn't it? For unity.
Mm-hmm.
We're so far from that right now. And I think trust and fear, idolatry, there's so much tangled up in that I would like to see trust restored.
Yeah. That we, as Christ followers, would be trustworthy again would be.
Yes. Yes.
Be wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tiffany. I really appreciate the work that you do. I've gotten to directly benefit from your work by partnering with you at ACU Dallas, and your leadership is just incredible, and I thank you for that. And I thank you for your heart for the church, for ministry, and for what you're doing to help people, you know, across the United States and beyond to be better equipped for serving in the kingdom. So thank you for that. So we at Common Grounds like to close out our podcast with the thing we call Lightning Round, where we ask random questions that catch you off guard and make you say something embarrassing. So we'll give this a try.
You didn't even put this in the notes, Drew.
So, I know, okay. I hit
totally
it.
Totally caught off guard.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Oh, do you have a favorite city?
St. Louis, which is not my favorite city, but that's what comes out. Okay, so that's what I'm supposed to do, right? Just say it as it comes out.
It's like a
I grew up there. Yeah, I grew up there. That's where I was born and raised. So when I think city, I think like Cards baseball and Blues hockey, and which is fun.
Yeah. All right. In the morning, what's your favorite beverage?
Coffee. French
and
roast.
How do you drink it? French roast.
Black. Dark. Black. Yeah. Necessary awesome. Inference.
You I'm are keep a true academic. Academian. let's see. If you owned a boat, what would you name it?
Shirley.
Shirley.
I don't know why.
I like it. I like it. What is your favorite I'd say ethnic food, but just unusual food? What's your favorite food that maybe not everybody is like on board with?
Indian food. Really spicy. Yeah. Spicy.
Yes. So good. Other than Jesus, who inspires you?
The first person who comes to my mind is my daughter. So.
Wow. Yeah. Tell me Gilead about her.
Rain. Yeah. Gilead Rain. And she has special needs. She has low IQ. But she is the most persevering, hardworking, like leans in to life on everything. It's just the most inspiring thing to watch. She's fantastic.
That's wonderful. Would you willingly do karaoke?
Yes, and I have.
Excellent. In Korea, they have these noribangs, song rooms, and it's private karaoke, so you could just have only your friends in a room and do karaoke, and I thought that was a brilliant idea, because being in front of strangers doing that, it seems a little intimidating. All right. Let's see. Somebody gives you $500. Do you save it or spend it quickly?
$500 or $5,000?
$500.
Spend it.
Spend it. Awesome. Do you already know what you're spending it on?
It would be something for my kids.
Yeah. That's parenting.
I know. I know. Maybe something they would like, though. Like they, you know, kids get a certain age and shoes change. Like when they're in elementary, you can get the Walmart shoe, but once you get like 13, 14, you're dropping hundreds of dollars on shoes. I'm sure there's parents out there who just don't do that, but I would get them the shoes that they want.
Well, thank you, it's been fun talking to you, Tiffany. I really enjoyed this session, and hope it is a blessing to our listeners. We at Common Grounds have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. We want to imagine the good news of these gatherings, modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world. So please help us by providing us comments and suggestions. You can do that by emailing me at drew@commongroundsunity.org. And if you are benefiting from this ministry, then we ask you to consider making a monthly donation to support the work. And you can do that at www.commongroundsunity.org/donate. Really appreciate those who are contributing to this ministry and helping us to continue the work we're doing. And we hope to be blessing you in return.
Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. If you benefit from this ministry, please consider a monthly donation by going to www.commongroundsunity.org/donate. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.